Welcome. Today is Wednesday, July 24th, 2013. We're back on record with House Finance, Health and Social Services, Intermediate and Fairbanks. Today we'll be discussing sequestration, followed up by a division follow-up discussion. Members present are Representative Higgins, Holmes, Stoltz, Millman, Osterman, Amy Wilson, Representative Munoz, my friend, and Kawasaki, Representative Kawasaki. Today, I think, starting out, we have Josh Appleby from the administration. And Reed.
We'll also be over, Josh.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Josh Appleby. I'm Deputy Director for Healthcare Policy for the Department of Health and Social Services. And with me is Reece Sailors, our Deputy Commissioner. When we were first asked to make a presentation on sequestration and its effect on the department, it was kind of a broad, tell us about sequestration. And so as we sort of narrowed it down and wanted to bring some more specific numbers. But first I'd like to start with just a sort of a description of what sequestration is and what its goals are stated to be. And then,
excuse me, did we get a copy of what you're doing, or did we get it? Did the department send us any information on what you're presenting today?
No. This is just this is my notes here. And then I also, and I can provide this to the committee, the White House sent out a press release on the effects of sequestration on Alaska. It's very political and has a lot of spin in it, so I didn't know if you really wanted to distribute this, but I'd be happy to give this to you so you can. So under federal legislation, the term budget sequestration, or as some people call it, the sequester, refers to automatic spending cuts in particular categories of federal outlays. In 2013, specifically, sequestration refers to a section of the Budget Control Act of 2011 that was initially set to begin beginning of this year, January 1st, as an austerity fiscal policy. These cuts, if you remember, were postponed by 2 months by the American Taxpayer Relief Act until March 1st, when it finally went into effect. The reductions in spending authority were approximately $85.4 billion during fiscal year 2013, with similar cuts in the years 2014 all the way through 2021. One of the things that I'd like to point out is some people think that the sequester was a one-year sort of event, but it actually affects all fiscal years through 2021 and actually beyond. The Congressional Budget Office estimated the total federal outlays to continue to increase even with the sequester. So federal spending continued to increase by an average of $238 billion per year during the next decade, although they projected that the growth is going to be at a somewhat lesser rate. The cuts were split evenly by dollar amounts, not by percentage, between the defense and non-defense categories. Major programs like Social Security, Medicaid, federal pensions, veterans benefits were exempt. By a special provision of the Budget Control Act, Medicare spending will be reduced by a fixed 2% rate per year. Federal pay rates, including the military, were unaffected, but the sequestration may result in involuntary unpaid time off we've all heard about, and that's the furloughs. So we've already seen how those affected even people here in Alaska. The sequester lowers spending by a total of approximately $1.1 trillion versus pre-sequester levels over the eight-year period between 2013 and 2021. It lowers non-defense discretionary spending, domestic programs, by a range of 7.8%, that's the high in 2013, to 5.5% in 2021 versus pre-sequester amounts, for a total of $294 billion. Defense spending will likewise be lowered. Savings in non-defense mandatory spending should total $170 billion. Well, interest would be lowered by $169 billion.
Hey, Josh?
Yeah.
Josh, when you're going through these numbers, do you know how much the effect on Alaska's amounts are?
Well,
I mean, we're getting all the.
I understand.
$232 billion doesn't mean much to me.
I understand. And I just wanted to give a brief overview of the sequester, and then we'll get
then
into
we'll
the specifics. Yeah.
Okay.
The Congressional Budget Office estimated that sequestration would reduce economic growth by about 0.6 percentage points, but I think we've seen that be more in recent projections of economic growth. So specific to non-defense discretionary spending, which includes cabinet departments and agencies, the Congressional Budget Office predicted in February that under the sequester, non-defense discretionary spending will be reduced by $615 billion in 2012, and then $586 billion in 2013, 4.7%. So that was the original reduction. And then the spending will fall again by another 1.6. So when I say that we have the big hit this year, there'll be a second hit coming in the next year, it'll be a reduced amount. Non-defense discretionary spending will rise then gradually from $576 billion in 2014 up to $709 billion. So they've tried to keep the annual growth rate at 2.3% over that period of time. And so the period between 2014 and 2023 should average out to be a growth rate of 1.3%. As an example, annual spending growth from 2000 to 2012 was 5.6. So they looked at the 5.6 and said, we need to cut this back, and they came up with this plan. Non-defense discretionary spending will fall as a percent of GDP from 4% down to 2.7. So they're projecting that gross domestic product will increase as our spending remains flat at 2.3. So when you asked us to make a presentation, I know the one thing that you're most interested in is how that's going to affect our department. And Reese Ehlers has been so kind as to put some of these numbers together for you.
Good morning.
This is Mr. On the federal level.
Yes, Representative Stoltz.
I follow some of this stuff just on the news. Is the Affordable Care Act / Obamacare, is that exempt from these cuts?
Representative Stoltz, through the chair, some but not all. It's interesting that, for example, the federal federally facilitated marketplace, the exchanges where people go to buy insurance, the dollar amounts to advertise the marketplace and get people to sign up, the dollar amounts for the getting the word out, marketing, were cut under the sequester. But the actual dollars going to states for setting up their own state exchanges or the money to actually develop the federal marketplace were not cut. So it was real, it wasn't across the board under the Affordable Care Act. But it was kind of specific within the Department of Health and Human Services.
You mentioned states, the ability to set up their own exchanges, market exchanges. We have one. There's a site set up now for Alaska. How much was put forth towards Alaska? Do you know, Jess?
Mr. Chairman, the state of Alaska opted to not set up its own exchange, but to go with the federally facilitated marketplace. So the marketplace that will be operational in Alaska has been set up and paid for by federal government. No state funds for that.
Right. I was just wondering how much federal government put towards that. But I know that I've seen websites where people can still go in and get into that marketplace through the Internet.
That's correct. They've revamped their website at healthcare.gov for that purpose. But they haven't released a breakdown of how much money they've spent in that development. And I think several states would be very curious of how much the federal government spent to develop that program.
So good morning again. My name, for the record, my name is Reed Sailors. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. I wanted to try and give you some estimate of the impact on our department based on the information that we have so far, which is in some places sketchy, because we have to wait to get the figures from the federal government in terms of what the actual cuts are going to be. And in some cases, we have indicators from that. We don't always have confirmations of that. And then also, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about how it hits into the department. It is not an even across-the-board type of impact that it has, because certain programs were exempted from the federal sequester, and that trickles down to us. So pertinent in that would be Medicaid is exempt from sequester, TANF is exempt from sequester, food stamps or SNAP. So TANF is temporary assistance to the needy families, and Ron Crayer talked to you about that yesterday.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Phil.
Just on the record, I had some questions and discussions about how temporary assistance was, and afterwards one of the past officials said, well, I had a little mea culpa, that well, there are things that makes it virtually permanent. I'm wrong occasionally, like pretty often. Point out that I wasn't on that one, and there are some loopholes you can drive some trucks through on that. Temporary is nowhere near temporary. Just we'll save their presentation where I'll do their mea culpa for them. We'll save some time.
So some of the other exempt programs are the SSI programs, so supplemental security income, and that's for the disabled. As I said, TANF. And also SNAP or food stamps, so that's supplemental nutrition program. Some of the other nutrition programs are not exempt. So as you look at the department and sort of where do we bring in federal dollars and how do we match them up with general fund, you'll see it's it varies all over the place in terms of what the impact is across the division. So some divisions get hit a little bit harder than others. Some get hit a little lighter. Amounts that we are looking at or the percentages that we're looking at vary also in terms of the first round in our estimate for fiscal year 14 because of several other things that are going into in the play. And some of that includes the federal government having, because of their fiscal year and because of how they appropriate their dollars and how they provide grants to the states, there is sort of residual money in the pipeline, if you wish, that is due to the states that comes from a previous fiscal years that weren't subject to the sequester. So it's like the sort of dregs or leftovers from previous that haven't really been pushed out to the state. So for us initially, that will be a slight mitigating effect for us because there will be still a few federal dollars that will come to us that haven't been delivered, so to speak, and that are in the works in terms of our existing present situation.
And Ms. Salage, when you're talking about those funds that are still available that have been appropriated but not yet spent towards the state, in what areas? What areas are we going to see that in? Do you think? We're trying to. Here's the part of the problem that we're trying to also here I think figure out. Is we're trying to figure out how we're going to supplement these funds, where they're coming from. So if you can give us any information on where those funds are coming from, because we still have to try and deal with the fact that, and I asked Mr. Appleby earlier, and our legislative liaison's not here, who talks to the governor's office every day, that trying to get information and work together on how to do this budget when we have no idea what you guys are planning there is difficult. So. Anything you can
it is. It's frustrating.
It's very frustrating to sit here and make notes trying to keep up with and understand. You sat in front of Finance Committee and Bill and had the same conversation. Provide us with the information. It goes in this year, not this year. I'm trying to keep notes. Same thing over here. You talk to us, you talk to us, you don't give us information. You refuse to write it down. And that's very frustrating for us. My reaction right now is
Representative Osterman.
This information we get here today, you don't have a bit of it.
We can follow up with the written information as we get it solidified. I'm working off my personal notes. Based
well, that's fine. Your personal notes, but you've known for months that you're coming here and talking to us about sequestration. So working off personal notes does not help me one bit. We've had this conversation before. You guys refused to sit there and give us the information other than to talk. That's very frustrating to sit here and try to absorb this information, and then 2 months later maybe get some information from you. Right? Doesn't work.
Or if there may be funds available that are still in the pipeline for some of these programs. We're trying to figure out how to backfill. I asked Mr. Appleby earlier, do you have any concepts where you're going to be backfilling, how you're going to be backfilling, what you're going to be backfilling, with what?
And I think I have some estimate of that.
We can't talk to you about that.
And I do have some estimate of that for you. So as I go forward.
So get us all the information that you can as soon as you can, please.
So the part of unobligated or as yet delivered federal dollars, we don't have full knowledge about that because that belongs to the federal agencies. And their willingness to show us or their ability to show us how much that might be is not readily apparent to us, nor have they notified us of that. They have discretion about those things, and we don't control that.
The funds that have not been sequestered, you know what those funds are coming in. You know the funds that have already been appropriated that unspent towards some of these programs are. Those are numbers that we should be able to see right now.
Okay, so let me just.
Thank you. Okay, so let's, even without sequestration, we've been backfilling for years different federal programs. So if we just even talk about the federal funding that's coming in right now, how much of that, even with sequestration, even if that wasn't happening, we've still been backfilling. Amanda told us about some of the different programs. But can you tell us in this next year what we could even be looking to backfill, even if sequestration wasn't going?
Well, I can try and give you an overall, and what I'm prepared to do this morning is to give you an overall estimate of what we think the department-wide impact is, an estimate of the dollar amount of that, and some information about which divisions are affected and what that estimate of their effect is, both in terms of dollar amounts and percentages. That's what's in my notes to try and get you, which is what I've been scribbling over, you know, trying to pull this information out based on the latest information that we have available to us from the federal government and based on what we've been able to look at our own budgets to see. So I'm more than happy to do that, and that is my intention in terms of what I'm trying to present to you.
I guess I'm asking, because to me these are two different numbers, because we've been backfilling not just in health and social service, but education, DOT, just about every agency every year comes and says these federal funds are – the grants have gone away or the numbers have gone. So we've been dealing with that for a long time, knowing that that was going to happen even without this other. So we've got this pot of money that, you know, that's been disappearing. And maybe, I mean, you should have actuals on the last year, how much we ended up backfilling on this last budget. And then you have sequestration over here, which is a whole other amount of money that the federal government is going to cut out of programs that you normally would not have seen those reductions.
Right.
So, you know, one, you should already know because we've been doing it and should have numbers from last year, what we backfilled and what you anticipate, whether it be the same amount of money or more. And then at least percentage-wise, 5%, 10%, and what that comes out, you know, overall based on, you know, taking out these exemptions. So I guess I'm looking for both amounts.
And what we were asked to do and what I'm prepared to do is to talk to you about the sequester part. I did not go back over the appropriations from this past year and count the dollars that were, in essence, a backfill to lost federal dollars. So I only came prepared to talk to you about the sequester aspect of this. We weren't asked to prepare the other. And we can obviously go back through what actions you took this past session and indicate where we were doing replacement of the loss of federal dollars.
That would be of interest to the Finance Committee. They're just numbers.
So,
well, and those are decisions you made, then we can easily bring those forward.
What we need to do now, Ms. Allen and Mr. Appleby, is present us what you've got. Please try and provide as much information as far as numbers as you can. This is not your first rodeo. You've been doing this for a while. You're very informed. You're not an uninformed person. You give us your best estimates on the numbers as you can. Try and get us as much information as you can while you're doing your presentation.
Yeah. And we will follow up providing you with information in writing as soon as we can get it typed and distributed.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I've run into a lot of HASS employees around the state, and we're at one event, and I said, well, so-and-so is not here. They're really busting to get all this information ready for the finance committee up in Fairbanks, and everybody is going double and triple time to get everything ready. Boy, if that's your game, if this is on your game step of being prepared for Fairbanks, I'm just wondering why everybody had to skip all their extracurricular activities. It just blows me away. It's just an observation. This wasn't my favorite thing to do, and certainly staff has relayed it's not your favorite thing to do, but it is. It's in the job description.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll probably just shut up the rest of the meeting.
Well, you're right, Mr. Still, there's a lot of effort goes into doing this. You know, we try and do our best that we can. So, give us what you got.
So, as we look at things and which programs in our department have funding that is subject to sequester, because not all funds are subject to, and which ones we know that are going to be subjected to that. So, for instance, in behavioral health, the funding in behavioral health that is subject to sequester is about $5.8 million. We expect in fiscal year 14 that we will probably get about a 5.6% decrease in federal dollars subject as a result of the sequester, which is about $328,000. In the area of public assistance, we have $39 million that are subject to the sequester actions. And of that, in fiscal year 14, based on what we know now, we expect probably about a $1.6 million reduction or about 4.2% there. One of the things you'll notice as I go down this list is that the percentages vary. They're not all a constant 5% or 4% or whatever.
While we're getting these numbers, Ms. Ellis, if you could give us what these programs are currently funded at, there's this much funding less available through sequestration or available through sequestration, and it will be reduced by this much because we don't, you know what those balances are starting. I'm trying to figure out what those numbers are coming from.
Right, and what I'm
beginning balance.
What these numbers are coming from is the total amount of dollars within a division that it will be subjected to the sequester, and then what we think based on the percentage information that we've been given by the federal government so far, or what we're estimating based on what they've told us, how many of those dollars will be reduced. So I'm trying to show you in each division. There's a total sum of money that is subject to sequester, and then based on all the information that we have right now, what we anticipate the loss of dollars will be and what percentage of that total amount of dollars that's subject will be.
What I'm asking for is what is the total funding for each division currently as it stands? You're telling us how much is going to be is up for sequestration,
yeah.
But we don't know what the total is to start with. What's the agency current funding levels that we are starting with?
And I did not bring that. I did not.
Okay.
Again, I focused in on just trying to give you as much information about the sequester impact. In the area of public health, we see a pretty much across the board to all their programs the application of sequester, which is about $28 million will be subjected to sequester. And we anticipate, based on the information we have so far, about 4.2% of that will be taken, and that amounts to about $1.2 million. In the area of the Office of Children's Services, there's $7.9 million that will be subject to sequester activity. And there we anticipate about a 5.1% reduction. You have already done one backfill of the loss of federal dollars there in this past session. That amount in the fiscal year 14 we estimate to be about $402,000. In the area of senior and disability services, there are about $8.3 million that will be subjected to sequester, and we anticipate $366,000 will be the impact of that, and it's roughly about 4.4%. The department in toto, the amount of dollars that would be we anticipate in fiscal year 14 is roughly about $4 million total. So the other thing about sequester is because it goes on for a decade, it has a cumulative effect. So in my mind, I tried to figure out how does that work exactly, and so I used I just took $1,000 5% reduction each year for 10 years. What does that mean to the base? And basically, that $1,000 becomes $600. So if you hold everything else constant and you simply apply what the average impact year to year is going to be of the sequester, then what you see happening to your base funding over the decade is it reduces from $1,000 to about $600. Again, the other thing I can share with you is within a division, we don't have exact figures, but we do know that different programs, depending on where they're getting their funding from in the federal government and what the federal government's actions are going to be, we do know that it can range. In public assistance, it ranges. One program might get a 1.9% cut, and another program might get a 9% cut. We, for instance, the heating assistance program at the federal level, LIHEAP, we do know there's a 9% cut coming to LIHEAP from the federal government. So, again, we're looking for these numbers as well. We're trying to get information from the federal agencies as they're trying to get their act together. And as soon as we get the information, we're trying to figure out what the impact is on our department as well. So I think I'll just stop at that point and see what comments or questions you want.
This is actually partly direct this to our co-chair of the operating budget. As we're dealing with this uncertainty, and we refer to the base and reduction of federal money, we're starting this process, kind of a jump start on our caucus bill on what's sometimes called the audit, sometimes called zero-based budgeting department, my department. Does that make your job easier if we just go to a zero base and we can make a better evaluative judgment on whether or not to take those federal dollars? And if we have this slipping, eroding base that with uncertainty, would it make your job easier as an administrator to start out tests as a zero base as we're trying to evaluate the uncertainty of federal dollars so we can make our value judgments on general fund dollars, expenditures, and the best leverages? You don't have to. I'll just anecdotally tell a department. I was one of the agencies, a big one, and Representative Munoz is probably familiar with this one. The Board of Regents, I guess I'll spill the bag here. They asked one of the directors at UAA, what's the continuing cost going to be? He said, none. No continuing cost. It's in the base.
Oh,
and that was the answer, and he repeated it a couple of times. And that is not an ununique answer you'd get from a lot of people within the administration that say, no, there's no increase. It's part of the base now. It's part of the – and is this – and I guess I did a little editorializing, but I need to frame that. You ready to jump in with zero-based budgeting so we can make the best decisions?
First of all, in that previous comment, there's no such thing as a free lunch, so we don't think that the base is for free. And I think for us, already internally, we are going through the exercise of looking at not just our would-be increments or decrements, but also looking at our base, too. So the legislative branch sets, you know, how you want the budget to be presented to you, and we can follow whatever direction you give us. We routinely and particularly now are looking constantly at our base programs and asking ourselves the questions, you know, is this program necessary? Can we do it better? Is there some way that we can leverage funds more efficiently than we're already doing? So that is an exercise that we do internally as we examine our own budget. And if you wanted to have the budget presented to you that way, that's your discretion.
Okay.
Just to follow up just briefly, Mr.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's already in the culture of the department, because when you all departments, because you refer to a not funding an increment as a reduction, so that's already the basis so embedded in the culture of how you talk about the budget, and it's that's the way you talk to the media, that's the way you talk to the legislative branch.
Shut the fuck up, God.
I guess is that.
Could you please? I don't know who's on the phone. Who's on the phone?
I know.
Please mute any outside phones.
I sometimes get that kind of reaction from provocative statements. But, and is that? Well, that's part of the community.
All outside phones on mute.
I just want you to know this is Les Guerra, and that was not me.
Mr. Chairman, I believe Representative Stoltz brings up a very interesting concern about really it's the continuation of federal funds and the reliability of federal funds. It's certainly a concern of the governor of just how much of these federal funds are going to be there tomorrow, next year, the year after that, and constantly looking at that and making an evaluation of, well, if we're going to switch from general funds to federal funds, how stable are those federal funds given, you know, the overall budget constraints of the United States? And so making that evaluation, making that a part of the budget process, I think is very important.
I think we just served some notice, Mr. Co-Chair, if nothing else. Thanks, Mark.
Representative Holmes.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And along those lines, this is good to hear that the $4 million number, sort of the bottom line of what we anticipate, that was helpful. At this point, do you have, outside of the sequester, like we've been talking about for the last few minutes, we see across pretty much every budget where we receive federal funds, we see things that are not sequester-related but are just disappearing federal funds. Do you have any predictions on what you, on other things, non-sequester-related federal funds that we might be looking to supplement, having that you might be asking us to supplement for that this might be disappearing in the near future?
Representative Holmes to the chair. At this point, we don't have a list. We are beginning our budget process to examine what our requests will be and what resources we think we'll need, and that will be part of our process, is to try and find out and identify where we know other funding streams beyond the sequesters. And the other thing, I will qualify the $4 million as this is preliminary and based on what we know today, and we're not sure how the federal government is going to respond and what they're going to do exactly, but these are the ones that we feel pretty comfortable giving this estimate.
That goalpost does move on us periodically.
It does indeed. But, you know, we try and be flexible and go with the flows.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. You mentioned that $5.8 million expected cut to behavioral health. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't seem to add up to the $4 million total when you start going through all of the different categories. Could you explain those numbers again, please?
Yes. The $5.8 million in behavioral health is the amount of federal dollars in that division that will be subject to sequester. So it's not the amount that will be cut, but it's the denominator, so to speak, of the cut.
So what is that amount? Because we didn't get it a while ago. We said 5.6% decrease, but what was the amount?
$328,000.
Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so when is your budget due to the governor?
December.
That's when he has it. That would be really close.
I think ours is due in sometime in November, this part of November. I think about a month or so before it goes to you.
Okay, so if I was a business person and I was getting my funds from some outside source, a bigger business or whatever, I would know which one of those funds are coming in this next year and which ones besides the sequestration isn't. So who in your department keeps track of all the different grants that come in with the federal government, you know, what the term is, whether they're 5 years, 10 years, or they automatically come in? Because that's where my frustration is. I know the sequestration, you're waiting for the federal government,
you know, to do their thing. But you know what grants you get right now from the federal government. You know how they've cut them in the past. You should, because that's how you run your department. So I'm finding it hard that you don't already have a pretty good idea of the backfill just on normal years that we've already been doing. So if you had to go back and see what it was for last year, it just seems to me somebody in your department, that should be their job, watching how these funds come in and out and how secure they are.
It is more than just one person in the department who does that. Each division has that, and also our financial management services division creates support throughout the department for us to do those kinds of things. And part of what we're facing right now is a period of uncertainty that we haven't had in the past, that is new and that is a consequence of the whole activity that the Congress has engaged in and that the sequester brings to us. Again, how that gets implemented at the federal level then trickles down to us. And what is not clear at this point in time is all the decisions that the federal government is making, and then also the alignment between the different fiscal years that we have. Theirs is an October cycle, ours is a July cycle. So part of what we're doing is trying to contact our federal partners across all the divisions to try and get an estimate of what are the federal resources that we can count on and what's in play in terms of this particular thing. There is some, in the first year, there was like no discretion about moving these dollars across the programs or anything. It was like everything, no matter what, gets sent across the board. Nobody had any discretion at the federal level. But in the future, as this goes forward, there is some discretion that comes into play in this. So there's a set of decisions that aren't in our control that will be made by federal agencies about how they use their dollars and how they apply the cuts subject to, as a result of sequester. That, in turn, will affect the grants that they provide to us. We often don't get an amount of money from the federal government of how much we're actually getting in any fiscal year until we're sometimes a quarter into that fiscal year. They do not feel compelled to give us timely information. And so we constantly work to try and keep these moving objects in balance so that we don't make mistakes or that we're keeping in touch with what's happening. But their sense of, telling us for certain, and I mean, a different example is I'm reading a letter yesterday about something that happened in 2008 that we're getting the first notification from, or the second notification from them, about what we have to do about something that happened in 2008. So their sense of timing is not, they don't seem to have any sense of urgency. And part of that is because of their own appropriation cycle, which works quite differently from state fiscal cycles. You know, they often load their pipelines years in advance and then keep working on it no matter what. We have to determine what we put in our pipeline every year and make sure it balances out. Obviously, they haven't had to do that because we have the deficits and the problems that we have. So, it's trying to also get or wish for a culture change that has to come out of Washington and the bureaucrats that are there.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm hearing is, and kind of with Representative Phillips, not necessarily just being the zero-based budget, but maybe our budget should be based on state dollars only. I mean, if we can't count on the federal dollars, we don't know what we'll have to backfill. They don't know what we're going to have to backfill or what dollars. If we really want to make a budget that we know that we can keep within our realm, and I'm not talking about backfilling at all with federal, so don't get me wrong, I'm talking about only the current state dollars that we give right now, that should be what the budget is, because otherwise we're going to be obligating ourselves to funds that nobody knows whether we'll get or not, and that's not fair to the workers, and that's not fair to the state. And I don't know how else you get around knowing what kind of money is except to use what we know we have.
Interesting concept. Worth billions.
It's 8 billions.
Yeah. I'm still trying to bring myself down here and reel in here a little bit. Some of the exempt programs, you said that Medicaid, Social Security, temporary assistance, nutritional programs, supplemental nutritional programs were exempt. Now, we know that Medicaid is the largest part of the budget coming out of the federal government. believe probably 60%.
For the department's budget?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's close to that number, maybe 60, a little bit more.
66%.
Yeah.
And so we're looking at $1.7 billion there. And these are the things that I'm trying to put in my mind, that if you could help us that way, and that's what I keep trying to ask for in the numbers. And I guess we could go back when I asked for the original numbers for the divisions, and I seen people trying to go through their paperwork and find that. You've got your staff here. You've got plenty of lifelines behind you. I'm trying to bring this into a little bit closer to understanding what's going on because, you know, I know 2 + 2 = 4, but I don't want to have to sit there and say, well, we're going to get 2 and we're going to end up with 4 and have to do it backwards.
Yeah.
Okay?
And I appreciate the, you know,
but,
what you're looking for. And I think we're all trying to put that puzzle together. I mean, I'm thinking, when you ask me that question, I'm also thinking about, you know, the pie charts that Amanda presented to you, and I'm trying to think in my head, you know, what segment of that pie chart was federal dollars. If you look at our total department budget, what percentage of that pie is federal dollars on her pie chart? And, you know, I can't recall it, and I don't have it in front of me right now. But, and of that slice of the pie, which is fairly substantial, how much of that slice is actually subject to sequester versus in the exempt category? So you're right, Medicaid is a big chunk of that pie slice, and it is exempt from these cuts, as is TANF, temporary assistance, which is another big slice in that pie, you know, as is some others. But the reality is that then it leaves a fairly small slice of the federal dollars in our total budget that will be subjected to sequester, and that will be what raises the question for you and us of whether or not that should or should not be backfilled with general fund and whether it can or cannot be backfilled with federal.
So
I just didn't do that, but I think the information is there and can be assembled, and we can work on looking at how those pieces of the puzzle go together.
If I could give some direction, and maybe if my other members of the committee would like to have some suggestions other than what I'm going to give for the next time we meet, that's fine, but we're going to try and get this a little bit organized. We sent you questions more than 2 weeks ago on the original first 2 days. We did not get the answers back until probably Friday. My staff was working until 10:30 Sunday putting these books together. We're trying to get this information out to the members so that they can disseminate it, go through it, be prepared for these meetings, but we're not getting the information back until the last minute. I believe, Mr. Appleby, it was your suggestion to try and look at sequestration, or it came from the department to look at sequestration, how that was going. That was your job to put that together. Or say it was your job to put that together. I don't know. I see you're working off the notes, so I'm assuming you probably did this at the last minute, when you knew for weeks that this was coming. And how are we supposed to, as a committee, try and put this together? And it's an embarrassment for me as the chair. We've got members of the governor's staff shouting vulgarities out to the co-chair of finance. At least that's what I was informed it was. But we're trying to put this information together in our minds. We don't know where we're starting from the beginning to the end, how we're funding, what part of the funding it is, and it's embarrassing. We're talking about 40% of the state's budget with the HESS budget, operating budget. We're trying to figure out the effects of how that federal government's funds that are going to be coming in. And we don't have the information to try and do that at a finance committee where we take people from, you know, around the state are here trying to take their time out of their day, their staff. There's so much effort goes into this. You know, I'm ready to just pull the plug. I'm so frustrated right now. So if we can try and get the best information possible, start a little bit sooner so people are more informed for the effort that's put into this by these members trying to assist these people in this state. And we had to sit there and talk to those people yesterday in the last 2 days who do work on the ground. And here are the issues that they have to deal with. and then try and put all this together, there's a lot to try and consume here. We're all thinking about those people who have to go home after working 12, 14 hours a day dealing with rough situations all day long, overtime, the work that they're trying to deal with, the overload that they're trying to deal with. Then we have to try and look at reductions in their budget. That all weighs on us also. And trying to make the best decisions that we can is very important. And we're not getting the information that we need. So if there's ways that you can think of to try and get us better information while we're going through this presentation, please do it. If we need to take a break, you can regroup to get better information to us so that while we're sitting here, we can absorb it and comprehend it in a meaningful way. We'll do that. If you can just do it by, I mean, as the deputy commissioner and your director's right behind you, they should know what their budgets are. You have to ask and say, you know, what's your budget? Ron, what's your budget? I mean, let's do that. But we're trying to deal with this. So please try and get us as much information. Do we need a break or can we continue on?
Mr. Chairman, if you want us to get the totals of each of the division's budgets along with the total for the department, I'm sure we can probably get that with a few phone calls.
Let's take 10 minutes. I think it's going to be a better meeting.
I think we can look at the handouts that were prepared
and give you some
totals of what's in your notebook.
So we're looking at, let's just start at the top end with the largest portions of the budget, how they'll be affected, how you feel they're going to be affected by the federal government sequestration, and move down from there.
Yeah, I think what I will be able to do for you in a few minutes is to simply add for you what are the division totals, so that you can see of the total division total, what amount we know today is going to be subjected to sequester.
Okay.
You know, I did not do this in terms of reporting it to you as, you know, in relationship to an entire division's budget. I went in to try and find out what types of programs are funded from the federal government which were not exempt from the sequester. So we can take the pages out of your notebook and put that information into this thing. I will also be happy, Representative Osterman, I will give you my sheet of paper and have copies made so that you can have it. They are notes that I made in the course of preparing for this, and I'm more than happy to do that, and I apologize to you that I didn't think to do that, quite frankly.
Well, it's not like it's something new. It's something that's going on. It's an ongoing deal with the department of not giving us any more information than we absolutely have to, and allowing us to make final decisions on our own as to what needs to be done as far as this department is concerned. And you leave us very little latitude of what we have to do. Other than if we don't have the information, we have to make our own determination. That's fine if that's the way you guys want to continue this process. That's up to you guys. You know, and if that's the way the commissioner and you guys want to handle this, continue to handle this, that's fine.
Representative Austin and through the chair, I am really sorry that you feel that way. We have tried very hard to supply the information we've been asking.
And then show up here empty handed.
And I was not fully aware that you wanted a paper exercise on this.
We had a conversation in June at previous meetings, you know, when you'd make the same apology then as you're making right now. It's unacceptable.
And I just want to follow up on Representative Boston. And on that point, it's just when we tried to get to the budget and work through this budget from day one last January, and we asked for some suggestions, you know, a little bit of help. If we have to reduce it, where can we do this? And I believe the department tried to do that. Then we were told, you know what, this is the governor's budget, take it or leave it, cut where you got to cut. You know, and we know that we've got reduced budgets coming in $1 billion less. And we try and make that. The public reacts to those. And it's very difficult to try and do. Because we're not working together. We're not the experts. You're the experts. There's less money coming in. count on from the federal and the state. And where do we make those decisions? We have to have this is where it ends up in this discussion right here, just like this. Because of it. And that's enough on this for me. I'll take it up to the bottom right now. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. I think Representative Newman is making a good point in that, you know, when we get to the legislative process in January, then when we're having to make, you know, the proposals for cuts, then, you know, we meet a firestorm of political, you know, opposition. And so I think that, you know, right now you know that approximately $4 million will be affected in future budgets. So my question is, do you anticipate presenting a budget that takes into account those future cuts, the budget that we receive from the governor in January? Will that budget acknowledge those cuts and find those cuts in the proposal?
As we develop our budget, we'll make a series of decisions, some of which will be, I mean, we will certainly documentation of the budget process, but whether or not there's a recommendation or request to replace those are decisions we've yet to make,
okay,
because we want to examine that in our own budget development process, which we are just now beginning, quite frankly. So we haven't sat down as a department and said and looked at ourselves and said, okay, here's all these programs, which ones do we think and here's what we have in terms of current financing. Here's what we're doing with that mm-hmm. current financing. Here's what we anticipate happening to us as a result of the federal activity, and then how to put those together in making some kind of cogent programmatic and policy set of decisions that also will drive whatever financing we have available to us or will be married to whatever financing and assets that we may have or ask for. So as a department, we haven't done that. You know, we have finished making our developing our management plans as a result of breaking down all of the appropriations and then sorting them out into the divisions and turning them into management plans. We've just completed that because in order to be ready for July 1, so we've done a lot of that. We are beginning to prepare right now to start our budget development process. And so, you know, I anticipate, yes, part and parcel of that process that we go through each year is to look at what are the resources we have, what is it that we're doing that we need to continue doing, what is it that we're doing that doesn't, you know, merit continuing, and then what is the mix of financing that makes sense and that is available to us to have at the federal level and then provide a set of questions to you essentially about whether or not you want to invest the public's money to make up whatever that portion of the financing might be. So we are trying to prepare that information for you. I think in our cycle of how we do our work and what we have to do in what sequence, you're a little premature to what we actually do internally to make these things happen. So it's not that we're dodging giving you information. It's that the information hasn't been completely developed internally to our department yet. And, you know, there are things that we do, and then there's a cycle that we go into to develop our budget. You're at the very fringe of us beginning to do that. And so it's not that we're trying to play, you know, hide the pony kind of thing. We really are trying to give you the best information we have at this point.
Well, I'm not exactly sure how I should address this question. You know, when I was invited to come sit, you know, at this meeting, you guys know you're going to have a cut. I mean, you know that. Yeah, well, either 3% to 5% or even higher in certain organizations. So I guess what I would like to hear when you guys know this is not only do we know the problem, but we also want to hear a solution from you. I mean, how are we going to cut that? We're not going to have the money for it. You know, being new to the legislation and being chair of Hess, the thing that surprised me the most was when everyone came to my office and everyone just asked for money. Money. Like we got a money tree somewhere, and we don't. That's the problem. And we got to say no sooner or later. But you guys are the experts, and I think Representative Newman said that. You know, I mean, we really need your help in these areas. And so we need solutions from you, you know, and that would really help the process.
And through the chair, I think, you know, part of what we are doing right now is to try and to develop that based on trying to understand it ourselves. And I'll give you an example. And part of what I think you're asking is what's the programmatic impact and what can we do to mitigate whatever impact there might be that's negative. And so part of what we're trying to do when we get the information from the feds, it comes down differentially. So, and I'll give you one example where we've got a little bit of slightly better breakout in terms of how it hits. But, you know, for instance, in the child care programs, the hit there is about 6.5%. But when you look at the commodity food program, it's about 1.2%. So part of what we are having to do is each one of these things has a funding tail attached to it that's federal. And so as that information comes in, and then we look at that total picture in terms of what are the programs that are affecting and which programs are getting affected more than others. You know, is this cut to this program going to be sort of, you know, undermining it so much that it's not even going to be effective? You know, or is this cut something this program can sustain without doing major damage to the services or the people we serve? That is the kind of analysis that we will be doing internally as we develop our budget. But, you know, I cannot tell you today exactly what that is. Our job is to make sure we can tell you, but we also have to go through the exercises of getting that information, pulling it out of the federal government, laying it down against what we know in terms of our own internal information, and making a set of judgments about what is the impact of this. And right now, we just don't have all the pieces of the puzzle so that we can put that thing together.
And I appreciate Pete's question because that, in the end, that's where we want to be. And but today, we were having a presentation on sequestration. You just threw out some numbers that you knew you had. You didn't give them to us earlier when we talked about it. You didn't put any of the stuff in writing so we can sit down over the next month and kind of look, see where you go. Next month, maybe we'll get another report on sequestration and we can add the two together and look at it. But if you refuse to give us the written information and wait till October when you put your budget together and say, okay, this is what sequestration did to us, it doesn't help us at all as a committee. We've been spending our summer trying to figure your department out and understand it, and yet we don't get the information. And it's just very frustrating. I don't understand it. You know, we'll put our hand out to try to help figure out what we're going to do, knowing that we're going to have less money. And we're sitting here today, again, frustrated beyond unbelief. And it's, you know, we have to plan as well. And that's part of the problem, is that we're trying to get to that position of being able to plan alongside you guys and, again, get to this point where there's no information.
I just want to take it one step backwards, because through this process the last couple of days, and I had the same problem in Anchorage. Like when we went to OCS yesterday, we don't even know when the caseworker tells us that they have 30, you know, kids that they're taking care of, what does that mean money-wise? What resources are going into that child through all the different processes? I don't even have those numbers from that basic. So without even having those numbers, now you're going to come back with sequestration or the other financial part. But we don't even know what the numbers are currently, and you have to know that. I mean, I'm listening to you, and it sounds like you never even looked at how much it costs for a child or how much. I've talked to Ron, and I know we don't pay enough for child care for those parents to be able to keep quality child care. I never heard how much we're paying per child and how much it should be, how much is a working parent doing. So I don't feel like from the last two meetings that I even have the basic knowledge of what we're currently doing and what is costing us in each program, because it's buried in so many numbers. And same thing with assistance. There's all these assistant programs. How many people are there? How much does it cost between getting them that first food box all the way to maybe now they're working? So without that knowledge, then you can give me the sequestration, but I don't know how it impacts because I don't know. I don't have the regular numbers. And I said this the last time, and I'm just going to give you one example. And I'm glad you stopped smoking because of the commercials. But anyway, I asked, you know, how much is it costing for each person who stopped smoking? And you know the response I got back from the department? They took the amount of money for the tobacco program and divided amongst the population of the state. I don't smoke. I never plan on smoking. You can show me as many commercials as you want. Has no effect on that decision that I made. But the question was, with the money and the statistics that the department gave, how does it come up per dollar for it? Because I need those original numbers to know then how all these numbers will then impact our programs. Or and the last thing, it was my biggest frustration yesterday was, and this was especially with OCS, with these higher caseloads, are we actually not saving money but paying more because we're not getting these children back into the homes that we might be able to if we did this? But we're not even being given choices because, and thank you, Representative Newman, for doing this. It's most of the time, in 90 days, we're looking just at the figures, and we're really trying to put programs in front of us to go with the money so we're not just making a 10% cut. And the way it's going, I'm wondering why we're taking out the time to do it. But I'm not willing to quit.
Is there a way that, you know, we know that we're going to have some less federal funds, and we'll take the tobacco cessation fund for me. Funding available to keep that fund fluid was about $9 million. The department appropriated or asked for 11.7. This committee cut 2.7 because it was more than was sustainable to keep the fund fluid. The department went to the Senate and asked to put that money back in. Money was put back in. It went through the process. So there was another $2.7 million there. Is that money that can be used to try and backfill some of these programs? Now, there was $8.3 million in grants that had no label on it at all. It was not allocated towards any program. And it was capital funds, extra capital funds that were put in there. It was rolled into your operating budget. Is that $8.3 million or other funds like that available to backfill some of these programs?
Mr. Chairman, I'll give you what I hope will be a qualified answer, but my understanding is that the tobacco cessation programs are funded out of the earmarked fund that is for tobacco cessation that comes out of the National Tobacco Settlement. And so I think how you spend those dollars and whether or not the legislature can decide to take money out of the tobacco settlement dollars and place them elsewhere, I think that is available to you, and that is a discretionary item that you can make a decision
about. When we try and do that, we get pretty big fight back from the department. You're the one that is putting the budget together. I'm asking you, can you do that?
I think that the use of those dollars, I'm not quite sure right here today whether or not there's a statutory or language in the budget restriction on where that funding comes from and how it can be used.
Okay, how about like the $8.3 million in additional capital money that we rolled into your operating budget for grants, mental health grants, that you have the ability to spread around? We actually put specific language in the budget for abilities, for efficiencies, for bonus monies that are coming to the department to be able to move those around at the request of the commissioner. Can those funds be moved in to try and backfill some of these others? The deputy commissioner, can you answer that?
Again, I will give a qualified answer today because I'm on the cuff here. But my understanding is it depends on how you appropriate it and what strings are attached and what requirements are attached legally to whether or not we can spend that money differently. So, and I also don't know, I do know that you provided the commissioner with some discretionary authority this year to move funds, and so that will be, you know, we have to look at how that will be used, and I don't know whether that could be applied in this situation. So
yes.
Part of it is we can't just, as you well know and your staff has told you, we can't just take what you appropriate and just shift it over and pay for something over here. We can't move these things with impunity or anywhere we like. There are restrictions on where we can move dollars and how we can spend them.
Representative Stoltz, go ahead, because you can do exactly what you were just said, talking about earlier.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've been through these battles where the legislative branch, in particular in the bicameral side of the House, has tried to redirect what nationally and what your own health officials say, obesity, childhood obesity is a larger problem. Tobacco, one of the problems with the tobacco cessation is there's less money because people are smoking less, and that becomes a problem. But the legislative branch has made efforts to redirect it to another policy initiative, and the tobacco cessation lobby and department staff tag-teamed together in the building. And you can say you're agnostic on this, but I don't think anybody can really keep an unread face by saying that, because I've lived through that, and I've seen the staff work, and I've seen working together with the tobacco cessation lobby. There's a lot of inter. So it just doesn't. I said I was going to be quiet for the rest of the time. One thing I'm consistent about is I'm inconsistent. So, but you know, I won't apologize for that because I just couldn't take it much more. Saying, well, it's your decision. We don't have anything to do with it. Well, my God, that's a. I just can't take it. I can't take it anymore, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. I think you're consistent as you care, Representative Stoltz. You're trying to do the best that you can with what you got. We're going to take a break. Right now we have a scheduled break at 10:15. We're going to come back with a follow-up discussion with Division of Public Assistance, Office of Children's Services. I know the feedback from the legislators I got to talk to, again, the folks that are the worker bees underground was great. There was a lot of discussion yesterday about overtime, you know, the vacation rates or the amount of people that are positions filled but funded, unfilled and funded, going to overtime, how that affects those employees. Hopefully some of the directors have had a chance to queue on that and come back and talk to us about maybe what their thoughts are on that to help us solve some of those issues when we come back.
If I may, yesterday when we were at OCS and talking to the workers, I wanted to inform you that ironically, while we were in that room, the office in Anchorage was being evacuated. And so we want to thank you for the resources you put into our budget for safety. The armed guard who was there was part of what allowed one of the people who was threatening to kill everybody to be apprehended and arrested. So we just want to thank you. It became a very close-to-home issue while we were in that room yesterday, and the resources that you gave us paid off.
That's why Representative Stoltz asked about safety.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we'll take a quick break.
Budget Finance Subcommittee for the Health and Social Services back in. Representative Stolson Holmes has to catch a flight. So thank you for time while you're here.
Thank you for all of
the time. Is Amanda available? Amanda and David, are they going to come up and talk to us about sequestration a little bit? Or at least what their thoughts are? David Teals, will you come
up? David's alone.
She can join me.
She'll get here.
Not sure where she went.
Right behind you.
David and Amanda, you can introduce yourself and then kind of give us an idea of how you see sequestration affecting the state as a whole, and then maybe focus in a little bit on the Health and Social Services budget.
I'm David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division, and this is Amanda Ryder, Operating Coordinator. Finance started work on sequestration, I guess pushed some degree by sequestration itself last year, but we would have been leaning this direction anyway last year because we knew that the federal budget would be reduced with or without sequestration. And what we tried to do was say, well, where do we expect the money to go? So that we started creating a big table, department by department, program by program. Where does federal money come in? How much comes in? Is it subject to sequestration? If so, what's the likely reduction? And from there, you can say, well, now it becomes easier for you because if it's not subject to sequestration, pretty much drop it off the table so you can focus on what's important. If there's sequestration, you need to understand first that in some cases, sequestration simply means a reduction in the growth rate, not a true reduction. And I'm, you know, Representative Stoltz hits this issue constantly. If there's an increment request for $100,000 and you grant 50 of it, that is not a cut in the budget. That simply, we didn't give you as large an increment as you wanted. That's not true for all sequestration. Some programs actually do have a reduction. LIHEAP, I think, is one of them. And the bottom line here is that we can identify, or FFIS really does the identifying, what gets hit, how hard it gets hit, so that you can focus on the decisions that you need to make, which is really, so what do we do about it? We can accept the cut and reduce the program. We can, in some cases, if it's a match program and they cut the federal dollars, you can actually cut the match too if you decide that you're going to reduce services because the federal government has reduced them. Or you can decide you want to backfill. But the choice is yours. We're just trying to help you identify those choices so that you can focus on the impacts of your choices. We can resurrect that. We were frustrated last year, same reason you were, because as we tried to talk to the agencies about what would happen, we get the standard, we can't talk to you about stuff that might or might not be in the FY14 budget. This year would be the 15 budget. So, but I really think that it's not simply the Department of Health and Social Services that's hit. We should be doing this statewide. Mm-hmm. We should be doing the same exercise for every single department. And that Representative Osterman, we talk to Karen Layfield tomorrow, and I hope it's something that you talk to her about, because the departments have more horsepower than Ledge Finance does. We've got other things we need to do, so do they, but they are the ones whose programs are impacted. They should know this stuff, and I'd be happy to share the Excel table that we were working on last session, last interim, with them so that they can fill in the blanks to the best of their ability. But the department's correct in their testimony today they're frustrated too, because a lot of this stuff they simply do not know. And time after time at these NCSL budget meetings, we go in there and get told, well, here's your update. I can't tell you anything. I don't know anything. I know it's been 2 months, but nothing's happening in Washington. And even though sequestration is there, the details are not. So I can see the frustration of the committee, and it's kind of like, well, should I really go up in front of them, because it's a little scary at the moment. But I'm trying to ease your frustration by saying there are things that can be done to ease your decisions beginning in January. Some of them are difficult to do right now, but you will have that kind of information during the session. I know you'd like this early as possible, but if I start promising we'll finish a table by the next H&SS meeting, Amanda's going to shoot me, or my staff will.
My frustration wasn't necessarily on what the information is. My frustration was, here is the information we have, yet I didn't have this in front of me while I was talking about it.
Yeah. And what we did last year, it was create a fund code. That fund code is a special code. It's a general fund code, but specifically identifies money associated with sequestration. And I'd like to emphasize with Karen, and she agreed last year to use that code, and of course it never came up. But it would be identifying the amount of money that's backfilled. Also, if there's any federal cuts and it's match and you decide to cut the match as well, you would show a GF savings in that code. So you will always know what sequestration has cost you as a state. Now, if there's any good news here on sequestration, it's that the impact is not as large as some people feared. We were looking at the number that sticks in my mind, total statewide impact for the year was about $20 million, which is a lot of money, but it's not hundreds of millions, which I think was the fear. I mean, when they talk about hundreds of billions of dollars cut, and you wonder what our share is, and then you find out it's really not that large. I hope that eases your minds a little bit. Representative Wilson mentioned, you know, kind of in frustration, you simply leave the federal authorization alone. That works just fine. I mean, we have plenty of programs that have follow authorization in them. But as you all know, that's somewhat misleading in the budget world, because it looks like the program is fully funded when it truly will not be, and you can't get the public response. You don't even know what happens. It looks to you like the program is fully funded. And I know that as you make your decisions, you want to have an accurate budget, not one that shows follow authorization and a fully funded program that cannot fund its needs. So we will work on that table, or work with OMB on completing that table. And I know you'd like the information now, but I think we can do a lot better job if we wait until closer to the session.
And Dave, thank you. Obviously, we understand that. And the process is coming out of D.C. we have no control over. And I was just talking to the commissioner about that. He himself is trying to get information as best he can. But what we still need, you know, is as much information as possible. Time is going so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, going from 120-day to a 90-day session, all the legislation we have to look at besides just the budget stuff, this compacts our schedule so much. So for, you know, us to be as prepared, I know myself as the chair, working with the co-chair Osterman as the co-chair of operating, and his staff and my staff working with Amanda, and you trying to put all this together, the faster, the sooner, the better information we have, obviously, is better, best for all of us. even if it's just an estimate. You know, it, you know, here's what we think is going to happen. Because there's just so much coming at us. That's I think, what it is. But a little bit of frustration maybe on the organizational aspect of today's meeting. And I think we're over that, and we're going to be working to get that better in the future. Okay. Representative Wilson.
So along with that, then how do you fit in the normal, I don't know if it's normal, but the backfilling that we've done over the years, just from the reduction of federal funding outside of the host sequestration? Because every year, you know, every department comes in, and it's not their fault. I mean, it's not that the federal funding isn't coming through. But, you know, as we keep looking at each program, knowing what's coming earlier, can we just look at this year's budget and say, well, this is how much backfilling we did this year. We can anticipate it plus more next year? Because, to me, it's like two separate pots we're talking about. We're talking about grants at hand that are federally funded that we've started programs that the grant just runs out. So, therefore, you continue it with state funding or it goes away, which normally nothing goes away. Or just the funds itself have gone down. So is there any way that you can monitor that? Are you pretty well dependent upon, again, the department saying, you know, here's the grants and the years that we have for those, and I mean, to me, it's two different anticipations.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, you're right about it occurring. You're right about it being difficult to do anything about. The code we created is specifically to track the impact of sequestration. We like to leave it at just that, but we recognize that there are federal cuts that are not related to sequestration. And that's a slightly different issue. But if you want to identify more of that, the only way I can think of to do that is to say, stop transferring federal authorization across appropriation lines. And there's nothing wrong with doing it. I mean, if you know, there's extra federal authorization in Medicaid and it's and they're light in some other division or program, why not transfer it, right? Well, the answer there is you never see the reduction that the feds have made, and you might be better off saying, we want you to delete your federal authorization here because the program went away. We want you to ask for brand new federal authorization here. The result is the same in terms of dollars, but you could see more of what was happening.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we've also worked on a spreadsheet. And so we've kind of tracked some of that in a spreadsheet, but we have sent it over to OMB for just so that their analysts can check what we've done. And what we've done is we've gone back and looked at all sort of even some increments that we've done fund changes and we've done increments. Examinations of increments to see if they were replacing federal funds, but we did want to have that verified by OMB and their analysts, and I don't, and then they were going to add a few years to that. So, you know, we may be able to send you over the last few years kind of what we've done. So I'll check with OMB on that too.
But what we've done, we'll give you an idea of the size of the problem, but it's not going to be accurate. Never will be. I mean, but if you're happy with just ballpark numbers, it'll do it.
And David, all we can do is work with the best we've got. I mean, as a budget analysis, you do that every day. You know, trying to read the future with what the best is you got. You know, that's what we're all going to have to try and do here. You know, and I guess interesting thing about what came out yesterday too on some of the discussions is, maybe Amanda can help this because I know her and I have had this discussion many times. When we look at the amount of funded but unfilled positions and how those funds can be spent through the programs, is there a way to track that? And my concern is, you know, that you got those frontline social workers that are, I think, working very hard. I think they're very dedicated people with some of the worst jobs in the state. It's what they have to deal with every day and then go home and try and live a normal life. And I think we heard from them, I think, very sincerely yesterday and openly, and I appreciated that.
I think we all appreciated that
to a great extent. And I hope that, you know, that there's not any retribution there on those folks who are trying to speak openly. I'm sure there won't be. I asked you that. But is there a way to try and move some of these funds around so that we're looking at this or track funds? My concern is, you know, we're putting money towards, between the growth rate and the amount of money going towards frontline social workers. To me, that seemed to be a big part of reducing that stress level of having those people there. Is there a way to track on how much? Is it all going to overtime, or is it going to other funds or other parts of the department, or what's happening there? The personnel costs and that.
Mr. Chairman, we can see that. We can get reports out of Access that show, you know, by, well, everyone in the state, I mean, everyone on the payroll, we can see how much they get paid, whether it's hazard pay, overtime pay, et cetera, et cetera. It all shows in a run that we can download anytime we want. The issue I had with the vacant positions was primarily that, how are we supposed to know? How are you supposed to know there's a problem? What you see are unfilled positions, and you know they're funded. So it looks like, well, what problem? They're simply using the money for something other than personal services. The comment they had was pretty much, we have to spend overtime because we can't fill the positions, and all the money is being used for personal services, not in a way we'd like to use it. We'd rather have more people employed. The problem that I see with that approach is that it disguises the problem. You don't see it. We don't see it. OMB doesn't see a problem. And until they try something different there, like budgeting the overtime, and then, of course, what OMB would say was, if you budget your overtime, you now have a vacancy rate of 25%. That's unacceptable. You have to get rid of some PCNs. And you go, that's the point. Now you've shaken things up. Now people will say, I don't understand. Why are you getting rid of PCNs when you need more people? And you have an opportunity to explain your problem. But if you continue to disguise your problem, who knows? Who knew there was a problem? I learned a lot yesterday. I think it's great to be able to go out and talk to people and just accidentally find out what they're doing that they could perhaps do differently. And you know, I don't want to step in and try to manage, neither do you. It's not your job. It's not my job. But I think that in cases like that, we can talk to people in the department and to OMB and try to convince them that they're not doing themselves any good by disguising that problem.
You're right. I couldn't have said any better, I don't think.
I'd asked a question earlier from the department. With funds that are transferable through the department that were maybe appropriate, I mentioned that the $8.3 million that originally came in is some grant money for capital money for grants. And it was basically enrolled into the operating budget to try and cover some of those. But it was additional funds that were put in there that was not targeted towards any particular program. Amanda, is there a way to try and see how those funds are moved around, or is there, you know, as David said earlier, you know, as Representative Stoltz mentioned, you know, it's not a reduction if you're still getting more. But it always gets targeted as that, you know, in one way or another. Is there a way to track how those funds went, or can we use maybe any unallocated but appropriated funds to help backfill these, and is there a way to identify those?
Mr. Chairman, Ree's answers were spot on when it came to, for instance, the I think it's $3 million that still remains or something in behavioral health. The legislature appropriated that for behavioral health grants and specifically stated that it was for behavioral health grants in language. They cannot use that funding for other purposes. But with other funding that's more generically appropriated, that funding can be used for other things, and it can be transferred between allocations within an appropriation. And now, due to the committee's allowing a lot of flexibility with the $50 million transfers, there's also additional funding that can be transferred between appropriations. That funding, all RPs for the department, those basically any change in the funding, the plan, what happens if you want to transfer money between contractual and services line items, they fill out an RP, a revised program. They send that to OMB for approval. All of those RPs are sent to legislative finance. Many times they happen long after the fact, but there's a lot of them. I have a large stack in my office of RPs that you can walk through, and it's all changes to the budget. It happens in management plan, and it happens after management plan. And then any transfers from one allocation to another, you can see through those RPs. They're not always easy to read, but, yes, those are available to the legislature, and you can see those things when they occur. But you'll see a lot of that in the budget process when you get management plan, and that's why it does pay to look at management plan to see where funds have shifted to and from line items and transfers between allocations. So it does pay to look at the whole budget, the total budget when you get it. Looking at management plan is important.
Just for the benefit of the other members, what we did is tried to give the commissioner as much flexibility to oversee his budget as he could, knowing that we were going to have some of these shortcomings and the availability to move those funds around the best they can. And for me personally, as a chair, I think what it will help me do is identify with the red flags up, you know, where we're seeing that money has to get moved over to here to help see what's going on in that budget a little bit better.
And just if I may add, that was a pretty incredible thing that the legislature did, giving the commissioner that flexibility. I know that you're convinced that he needed it to manage the department, given the uncertainty, given the budgets, but that's unheard of flexibility, and with that comes some huge responsibilities, because he can now move money places that you didn't expect it to be. He can, you know, fund energy assistance completely if he chooses to do that. So that it's an incredible demonstration of trust in the department that, you know, I think is well deserved, and that it's necessary given the upheaval with their staff, with their programs, with funding. And I hope it gets them through the year a lot better than they could otherwise.
Representative Austin.
We've had several conversations in the past about undesignated federal receipts or federal money that has come in for a number of different things. We talked about tracking that, getting the report from the department on funds that they've received.
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, I have not received anything yet, but the department is going to be working with me on that. The assistant commissioner, Santa Evert, and I were talking, and she wants to more clarification how to budget that in the 15 budget, but also we have some cleanup to do on that. But for the most part, most of the bonus money that can be used for a lot of other purposes and very flexible has been budgeted as federal unrestricted, so you can see where it's being used. Some of it has not,
been identified as federal unrestricted, and that's, I'll be talking to the department about that too. For example, the SNAP funding that's going to be used in public assistance to pay for the position position for children's licensing, you know, that quality rating. That's going to be used with SNAP bonus money. That would appear as federal funding in the current budget, but it's not. There are no strings attached to that. They're really flexible, and you need to know that that is a choice to use some federal unrestricted bonus money to add a position for that.
Mr. Chairman, and that's why I asked the question. I listened to that yesterday when they were talking about increasing the child care program to the standard that they were talking about. And then in the afternoon, we listened to the whole guest. They're desperately in need for improved. We need to be able to see where those dollars are going and how the Department of Health is going. So I can get into this whole thing and the next thing you know, I'll have a news article about it. I don't like Facebook. So I don't want to get too deep into it. I don't want to get too deep into it, but, you know, those are the kind of things that we hope to look at over the time that we try to do this type of hearings over the interim. But, you know, somebody, we have to figure out track that so we know where those funds are going and how they're being used.
We will see that, and the only concern that we've had and have talked to the department about is that, you know, remember the ERA money. And the directives to do not use this to hire permanent staff that you then come back and say we need money to replace the money that we lost. Bonus money is the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It should be looked at as one-time money for using for a specific one-time purpose rather than filling permanent staff positions. But I think they understand that very clearly.
Thank you. On that point, Mr. Chairman, we've learned that there were frontline worker positions that were not filled, you know, that were that overtime was being used to cover the responsibilities of those positions. Can those designated positions be used for clerical and other type of support activity at the discretion of the director or commissioner?
Those positions would have to be reclassified to clerical positions, which certainly can happen and many times does happen. Of course, that means you lose frontline social worker positions. And while positions can be created, they don't need legislative approval. I mean, the executive branch does this quite a bit. It is tough, lots of hoops to jump through. You have to, you know, get permission from all the way up the ranks, OMB, governor's office. So there's a lot of political things behind creating positions also. So understandably, departments hate to lose their positions because it's very difficult to get that back. If you all of a sudden have an influx of frontline social workers and you've reclassed your positions to clerical, it's just not easy to add back in the positions. And then the legislature says, well, we added a lot of frontline social workers. Why are you asking for more? You couldn't fill the old ones. Mm-hmm. What's going on? And then having to explain, well, we reclassed them to clerical, et cetera. So there's a lot that happens with positions, which is why when the question was asked for me, of me, you know, how can we find out what's going on with the funding for the positions? There are a lot of reasons that there may be short funding as over time, increased cost in other areas, playing around with the vacancy factors. There's a lot of complexity with positions, which is why you really need to work with the department and figure out what's going on with the positions before giving you an answer. I'm not comfortable giving a top-of-the-head answer when I just don't know. For example, when I was working for Commerce, Banking had a 50% vacancy rate at that point. That's huge. What had happened is they had lost so many of their staff to the feds, and they were trying to fill their staff, so they had to contract out. So had you said, okay, well, you know, 50% vacancy factor, what's going on? Where's all that money? Well, they shifted it from personal services to contractual. But then they filled their staff later. I think now they're fully staffed, so they shifted it back. So the money went somewhere. They just had to contract with other regulators to go in and do bank examiners, bank exams. And so now if I had said, okay, you know, take away the staff, well, when they needed the staff, trying to create the staff again doesn't make sense, causes a lot of extra administrative work. I mean, there's a lot going on, which is why you have to hear the story of the division and understand, because every single division is going to have a different story with what's going on with their personnel.
But that's why you have meetings like this, because you cannot get those stories from looking at the budget. The only way you can get those stories is by talking about it division by division and looking at these things like those OCS stuff. I wouldn't do it. I mean, you couldn't get me to go knock on someone's door when they do not want to see you. I'm sorry. It's just kind of tough job. And I think you're on the right track to make those jobs easier by hiring the social work assistant so that you don't have clerical social workers, which is what you've got now. You know, you free them up to do their jobs. Why do they quit? It seems to me frustration. It's not the money. It's the frustration with being unable to do your job right. Mm-hmm. And you can't do your job right not because you're not qualified or capable, but because there's so much to do, and you're not given the resources to do it. How long would you sit and try to enter data in front of the computer? My mouse would be across the room. I mean, I don't have the patience to sit there and try to deal with things like that. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't have to, and neither should they be diverted from their real tasks by doing what's more clerical stuff. And maybe they would have a lot better retention their jobs weren't so frustrating, and you know, then they could fill the positions, and you know, to me it's just this circle. People quit because the jobs are bad, and then you can't fill them because everybody knows they're bad jobs. Well, make the jobs better, and recruiting is easier. So I think they're on the right track.
Yeah, David, it's. How do you make the job better? How do you make the job better for somebody who has to do an investigation of a young child that's just been raped? You know, you just can't make that job better. You just can't. But you have to provide that support services for the people who do have to do that job. Those people are sane, you know, that they're able to do that and go back home and try and live a normal life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you never know what's coming up. The next time that phone rings, you don't know what's going to be there, but you know it's going to be a bad problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what we have to do is try and support those people the best we can, and that was why it was so important. That I think it was wonderful what we learned there, and I, you know, the ability to hear that, you know, and as policymakers and budget makers, and we look at that, you know, the sense that those people at that front line have to do, and we hear it because we deal with our constituent issues every day, and we deal with the directors, you know, we call and talk to them constantly about that, and so we're exposed to a certain amount of. You know, I don't know. We will try and work it out with them. You know, I don't know how we're going to do it. We'll work through that one.
Well, they're back in front of you now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, so I've got some suggestions. I don't know if they'll help or not. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. And on another subject, on the early childhood that's in HESS, is there any way you could let me know why it's in HESS and why it's not in education? I have education in front of me tomorrow, just so you guys know you're not the only ones picked on. And I don't think they're probably tracking those early childhood grants and the students that are in it right now, which just seems a shame that we've got a whole other pot of money over here, children being helped and not, and those records not being utilized then for once they're 3 to 5 and they get into the system. And so especially since they're directed to special education, it just seems for me strange that it would be in HESS. Now, it could be like the Department of Labor had the independent living, which I'm still trying to figure out why it's in Department of Labor, except it's federal, and federal has said it's in labor. And so maybe the early childhood is the same thing where it's federal dollars, and the federal dollars have said it has to go into this division. If not, you know, I'd like to work with Representative Newman. If that's not the case, and I personally think it belongs in education so those students can continue to be tracked from the moment they hit a program all the way throughout their education purposes, if we can do that. And just one remark to Representative Newman, you know, you can't undo some of the awful things that social workers see, but we could give them the opportunity to help the families they really can mm-hmm. and have wins. Mm-hmm. Because I think we feel that in our own, as we knock on doors where we're not really wanted, you know. But, you know, we do this every day where we get frustrated with trying to work out things for constituents, and that one win that you knew you made a difference helps. But there's so much in the office doing paperwork, we're taking away that opportunity, I think, to have those wins that they need, because we can't do anything about the awful things. They have to see, but we can help them be more successful out there where it's exactly where they want to be. But I think technology is something we need to look at. You've got microphones now. You've got things that you can put in, voice ones, hook them to computers, and all that's written up for you. You know, computers you can talk to, and they write it all up. And the internet, we're going to work on where the schools have internet and why we're not letting the other agencies utilize it, because I still don't get that part. But I think technology, if you can't hire people, is something that we are way behind on, and those things are already out there and need to be more utilized. So they're doing it one time, and they're not retyping it. For some else to do it, goes right in. But it's those wins they need, absolutely yeah. need.
Any final thoughts on budget or sequestration, and we can kind of wrap up with the department? Thank you. Maybe Ron and Christy and Ree, I guess, come on up. And just on that point, while they're doing that, Representative Wilson, getting organized, Representative Osterman and I both serve on the Alaska Arctic Policy Council. And yesterday we heard about the inability for broadband and internet, you know, some of the things to try and deal with. I'm the team leader for infrastructure development. One of the discussions that we're having on how to increase, you know, our I used to be a development of the Arctic happening, it's going to have to be an expansion in broadband-type services like that. And it's interesting to see how that will assist Department of Health and Social Services do their job mm-hmm. in serving those Alaska. We'll do that.
But the interesting part, we've heard from the Commissioner of Education that all schools have plenty of broadband to be able to take these testing that's going to be done on the Internet, and somehow I just don't think that's true. So we will read all that out, and if we find those points and problems, let's give them to you.
Ron? Ree? Christy? Feedback from yesterday, or what did you think of yesterday?
For the chair, this is Ron Fair, Division of Public Assistance.
Just overview, any wrap-up on this is just a follow-up discussion, you know, with Division of Public Assistance and Office of Children's Services. What's your feedback?
Well, I've enjoyed this process. And for me, I've been the director of public assistance for, I think, only 2 years now. Have been involved in the budget process at the division level, providing information necessary to really capture our budget. I think, though, that some of the challenges that Christy faces with their staff and retaining staff, we face similar challenges. While our staff certainly don't have jobs that are anywhere comparable to the Child Protective Services staff, they're under a lot of pressure too regarding timelines, and they're seeing families with crisis. And just yesterday, after listening to what Christy's staff said, that we had a discussion about places how the Division of Public Assistance could somehow help in that regard, whether it was making it easier for family members who were taking children from a sibling into the home, how we can expedite that process, because there are alternatives to foster care. They can be non-needy caretaker relatives that are funded by the TANF program, and other options that we might have to support what becomes a non-custodial parent when their children are removed under the TANF program. There are some rules that allow us to provide services for those non-custodials. So in our department, over the last year and year and a half, we've been really working hard to figure out how we can better integrate our services. And frankly, I think that sometimes the way that our budget structure is, it creates silos, mm-hmm. and we get trapped by those silos because the funding is so limited in how it can be applied. So looking at things creatively to figure out how we can address those issues, I think, is very important for us, and we're working on that. But there are still federal rules that drive a lot of these funding requirements that say, you know, this person and not that. So that creates some challenges for us. Overall, we're really working hard to stay within our funding levels that we've given. We try to have as zero growth as we can within the Division of Public Assistance, but the reality of what we do is the vast majority of what we spend, the funds that we're able to receive from the federal government and through the state, goes to families and individuals and children. And well over 60% of the people we serve are kids. And I think that's a laudable thing for state to be doing, is to helping people in need. I think it's one of the prime drivers of government is to ensure that the elderly and the disabled and children are safe in our communities. So to me, that's an important job. Representative Wilson and I were talking earlier today, and I really walked into my job when I was an eligibility technician, largely out of gratitude from the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska has been very good to me. I've lived here for well over 40 years, and I want to give something back. I got into public assistance, and I had this very idealistic goal of trying to work myself out of a job. But the mission of the Division of Public Assistance isn't to end poverty. It's to provide a safety net for those people that are in poverty, and it takes a lot of concerted and systemic effort to make changes to families that are in poverty. And I think that, you know, and it's my soapbox. That is so important, and poverty affects the number of people that Christy has to serve, and it affects the number of people that DJJ has to serve. And I'm not saying that these are all poor people, but poverty is crippling. And it affects things like our obesity rate in this nation, our general health of people in our nation, the ability of our children to succeed academically. So I'll step off the soapbox now. So trying to work myself out of a job, I'm more likely to do that with loose lips than I am with trying to get my staff and, you know, to the point where they're really getting people off the rolls. So hopefully we can work effectively in the environment that we have to do that. But overall, I've never stopped eating sausage, even though I have seen it made and I have made it myself. And the experience that I've had over the last 2 years observing your commitment and the work of the legislature has really kind of changed my somewhat jaundiced view of government. In the legislative process. You know, I see people who are very concerned about Alaskans and want to do the best for them and are struggling with a very difficult budget. We do the same thing. You know, given what we have, we try to spend it in a way that demonstrates that we're prudent stewards of that resource. So I'm grateful for everything that you guys do for us.
And then, Christine and Reed, I was unaware that you now are the deputy commissioner. Former director of our juvenile justice system, which a lot of these kids are all intermixed, you know, in the youth. So anything you can add in there, you certainly got a lot of background in that. But Christy, any feedback that we can play off of? And members, if you got questions, I mean, here's your chance to talk. This is meant to be an open discussion.
For the record, I'm Christy Lawton, the director of the Office of Children's Services. A lot of similar sentiments, I think, that Ron said. Yesterday was a hard day. I won't deny that. I think that there was a lot of mixed expectations about what was going to happen this week, and perhaps communication both ways wasn't as crystal clear. So we weren't as prepared. I was not as prepared. For some of those reasons, I'm not pointing fingers anywhere. I'm just acknowledging a fact. I think yesterday afternoon with our staff, was very illuminating, and I know they absolutely loved having the opportunity to have you there and to have, I think everybody was able to make it, which was really appreciative. They're never under a gag order for me, and I specifically told them they weren't. Several of them felt bad. They got a weird vibe in the room, quite frankly, I think from the tension earlier in the morning, and they were a little bit not sure what that was about. But nobody said anything I wouldn't have said. So I'm sorry if you feel like it wasn't as direct in the morning, but the way that they describe it and the way that I might describe it is different. And they are a little bit freer to talk in their own words and their own language, and that was the intent. So there's absolutely no retribution. They were perfect. They did exactly what we wanted them to do, which is to talk openly. And they illuminated a number of things that clearly, either one, we haven't done a good enough job communicating all the way down to the frontline staff, from top to bottom. With 500 employees, we often have gaps where that information just is not trickling the way it should be for them to know what's happening on any given things. They also identified a couple things where I think we've got some regions perhaps that don't understand that some practices or policies have changed. And then there were things that I realized, wow, we haven't looked at that issue in a while, and clearly it's overdue. The spending matrix that was raised is one of them. And, you know, I grew up in the system like Ron, started as a frontline caseworker 15 years ago. I'm a social worker by, you know, education. That's how my brain works. Doing the budget side of things is a stretch that I've continued to try and do my best at in the 2 years I've been in the job. But that's also why I employ people that have the expertise to help inform me, and I try to put it all together in the biggest frame possible. It's a complex division, and as I'm sure you understood from all the various funding sources and all of that, to be able to have at the top of my head the answers to every question you might want to have, that's a tall order. But I'm dedicated to doing it. I'm dedicated to our staff. I've made a long list from yesterday to follow up personally with them on. I went through the office yesterday thanking them for doing such a great job and being so forthright. And they were very pleased and appreciative of your time and wanted me to express that back to you. And I guess I just wanted to also just offer, I know you guys are busy. You've a lot more than just this committee. And this was a great start. I think there's still a lot of missing pieces in your understanding how the organization OCS operates beginning to end, that then when we start talking causes difficulties when we're getting into the budget complexities. And everybody, I think, is at a little bit different spot given your experience or where you came from, your time. But I'm open to spending as much time individually with any of you. The interior delegation, I'm at your disposal. I'm in your backyard. I'm happy to go anywhere because it certainly is my goal to be as transparent and forthright. And I'm not a political person. I'm usually stretching the boundaries as far as I can in terms of talking as directly and frankly as I can, and that's my goal. So I'm happy to. We'll be working on following up all those things that you didn't get that you wanted. And I know there was a couple of other questions earlier that Representative Wilson raised about the tracking. That tracking is occurring, I believe, but if you haven't been able to get a clear answer of what that looks like, then we're still not hitting the mark. So that's something we can work on because that all stems from the committee that the council that Commissioner Hanley and Commissioner Struer co-chair for that very reason, to ensure that we're aligning those things. But if we're not able to describe it or give you something that reassures you of how that's working, then we've got some work to do for sure. And I guess I just want to end because I could go on for forever and ever. This isn't the worst job in the department, nor is it the worst job in the state of Alaska. I wouldn't be here after 15 years if that was true. I love my job. I love the people we work with. And by and large, the people we work with are all doing the very best they can to be the very best parents they can. They're struggling with issues that are getting in the way of that. And our goal is to help them get past those challenges however we can. And sometimes we hit the mark right on. Sometimes we fall short, and sometimes we exceed. And our goal is to continue to try and exceed, obviously, versus not hitting the mark. But it is a very tough job, and some of the reasons I think mentioned earlier are why. Because it's not the families we're working with. It's not the fact, as hard as it is to see children hurting, those generally aren't the reasons we're leaving. It might cause us some sleepless nights, but it is because
people like me are a little bit type A and perfectionist and get really consumed. If I can't do the job I need to do, and it's really hard to find a way to leave at 5 o'clock when there's always going to be a long list of work undone. And I'm not sure we'll ever change that entirely in child welfare because people are complex. Their lives are complex, and we're trying to manage human people's lives, giant families and kids that have dynamics happening every day. They're very volatile and changing and dynamic. So I'll leave it at that because I could take up the rest of the time we have, and I'll let you see if you have any questions. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. And I just want to clarify on the early childhood. It's not that I don't think you're aligned. I want to make sure that we're tracking the people, the children that there are, because I know that even with the so-called the pre-K pilot project, they weren't tracking them. I mean, we had them in there, but they weren't in the system in which we could see, you know, when we got them at, you know, 4- and 5-year-olds, you know, at third grade, are they reading now? So that's the part I'm concerned. Are we making sure that those that are being helped in this program, you know, are we looking at them as they go? I want to say thank you to both you and Ron. I know I can call you at any time, and most of the time you fix it the way I want it, but I understand when it can't be. So for that, I want to, but the connection I think that we made yesterday afternoon, and I was probably the one that told Kathy we don't need to make those trips, so I apologize, Kathy, because for us it's all numbers, and it has to be numbers to a certain extent, but, you know, you heard the testimony last year when we tried to make some, you know, some needed cuts that we thought that needed to be done, and the, you know, community from all over the state that came back at us. So, you know, we know especially in this one, and education being another one where this one especially affects those who are still trying to get back on their feet. So we need to be able to explain to our constituents why we made those changes and what kind of impact it had and where those impacts on the long term, especially in where you're at, if we make those cuts now, our children stay in foster care longer, we've actually cost the state more money, although on paper it may look like less.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that's what the committee is really trying to do is taking those figures, you know, and even if they're not perfect figures, but some figures on paper so that we can go back and say now, realistically, how many are you going to be able to hire? And, I mean, that fact you gave us yesterday about being the worst state as far as being able to get children back in their homes, I didn't know that. You know, I probably should have known that. And then you have to ask yourself why and how do we get to those points in a realistic way that we could sustain. So, you know, for me, I learned a lot that, you know, you guys do a lot. But at the end of the day, it is about the numbers. It is about what can we keep funding in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And you're always going to hit that. But the more we can understand it, the better we can explain it. Because we are always on those doors, whether or not they want us or not.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, thank you for the remarks. And just to clarify, we're not the worst state in the country. We're just not hitting the mark that is the average of all states put together. So we're doing better than some, but not as good as we should be. And that's to be true for any of those outcomes. Some we're doing well and some we're not. But I appreciate that, and we definitely follow up on the tracking element.
Well, that's facing some very unique issues. Again, communicative, most of our states off the road system, the communities of people that you serve, and trying to even pick up the phone and call them a lot of times to the worst. So there's some reasons for that. Representative Linus.
Thank you. Thank you to all three of you for the excellent work that you do, and the presentations were very informative, and it was very helpful to get out and talk to the frontline workers. The areas that I found most salient yesterday in terms of their ability to do their jobs was the lack of clerical support, or the need for additional clerical support, and also the problems with infrastructure, broadband infrastructure. And so if we could continue to work together to try to solve those issues, and if you can please stay in touch with us as you develop ideas on how to accomplish those two goals, or hopefully they're mutual goals that you know, I want to work with you. And I think the committee also was moved by those two areas as well. So thank you very much for being here, and thank you for your work. Thank you.
Thank you also on the candidness of where we need to be and what you guys need to have. as well, cold-hearted as it sounds sometimes, we are the number of people. But making those number decisions is not without realizing what the impact is. Mm-hmm. We're probably going into this coming year, or anticipate going into this coming year, with 19 million for a big time difference. So it gives us the big again, I don't want any of my remarks to be construed as not like the picture, but standing picture, and we have a problem with the picture becomes an issue. We'll mesh those things on our brain as we go through the process. That's what we're doing. Based on reference to what the balancing act is. And the hard part about it is that we totally recognize the responsibility of the department, the administration, their job. It's totally different than our job, as you guys really have. The hard issues to deal with, and how you do that balance act, how you present that budget. As we face shortfalls every year, we will be looking at areas that are being funded. We need to put more money in what that balance is going to be. I agree with everybody here today that we need to take a look at, go back and have more conversations with the department and reference for it. I'm assuming, because you guys live it, that the issue of more parking freeing up more time for your frontline workers. Not a new issue.
Yeah.
And you at some point in time, assuming anyway, at some point in time, come forward with a recommendation to the legislature that the emphasis has to change and the dollar value of the budget item has to change if we're going to continue to make improvements and get to where we need to be. Part of what I'd like to see from the department over the next few months and as we get into the budget cycle is that I applaud the governor in his choose respect emphasis on what's going on in the state of Alaska. And you guys, particularly OCS, are filling the bottom of that issue and what you're having to deal with in. How long is it going to take to, if we continue to fund the choose respect issue, the governor's initiative, how long is it going to take to get to a point where we're seeing some impact in your department, in OCS, and what you guys have to deal with, whether that burden is being eased based upon what we're initiative is trying to do? That's a conversation I think we need to have more candidly and more openly rather than the governor just coming forward with his request for funding every year. Because as we have to look at the shortfall in our budget, do we give less money to the governor for his choose respect to try to give it to OCS ourselves, or is there some kind of correlation going on within the administration in reference to where we're going to be and how we're going to get there and what the impact's going to be. I think that the objective of what we're doing here in these meetings that we're holding this summer is really an experiment. It's an experiment that hasn't been done before in reference to how the legislature and the administration comes up with a positive, concrete budget that we can all agree to and work with. If we can't communicate well, and if we can't get all of our information together and be understandable among each other, then it's a failed experiment, and we'll be back to where I've been before, and as a finance member, of taking the governor's budget and throwing it in the trash can and starting all over our own, because there's no communication, there's no working relationship, there's nothing that has transpired, and it's been that way in the past. The objective here through this experiment is to get that open dialogue and the conversation going. And I'm interested to see that time we get the budget from the department, particularly in OCS, and what your frontline workers, and it's going to be interesting to see whether there's a recommendation comes out that solves some of this problem. It may be something that we have to fund immediately at a higher level to get to where the truth respect actually takes away some of that burden. I don't know. I mean, that's a conversation we need to have as we go through the process. I'm very interested in continuing to have this dialogue and have an open discussion so that we get. Now, your department is the biggest department there is that we have to deal with, and that's one reason that we're doing it, because we wanted to take on the larger impact of our budget process that we have and be able to address it. And I guess I'll leave it at that. That's the objective that we're doing here.
We'll just maybe do a little wrap-up then. And, again, so appreciative of what we've done here. I know I put the departments on the spot yesterday. You know, they weren't expecting that, and I did that somewhat purposefully, try and have a candid discussion. Again, and it'll be beholden on, we look to our co-chair of operating, Representative Osterman, to look at this and some of these and maybe help break down the barriers of his position as a leadership position to work the administration to try and work on that. And he's very adept at what he does, and I'm sure he'll gain some ground there. But as I mentioned yesterday, having the committee as a whole with, I'll use Representative Munoz as an example because she's here, with the university budget, where can she be working with the university to make sure that we've got personnel trained to do these jobs? It might not need may mean that there's not a new $100 million building put up at the university. Maybe we should take that $100 million and put it towards staffing frontline social workers. You know, and so that's all these things that we have to train and put together. But she's very cognizant of that, very aware of it, and working as a dedicated as a committee as a whole to try and work on it. I think you have the support of every one of the members here in what they're going to be looking at their budget to try and. These are people's lives that we're dealing with. This can be a little bit different, you know. When you're dealing with the people who have to, again, deal with a child that's just been sodomized, raped, and beaten, you know. And how do you help that child gain back a sense of life to the rest of their life? That's something that will affect them the rest of their life, you know. And it's your people's job to do that. And making sure that they have the ability to do that so they can become productive members of society. They don't end up in juvenile justice and corrections and Department of Public Safety. And it all costs us. It all costs state government one way or another. And how are we going to go about doing that? But it's been an interesting discussion, I think, this week. I think we've all learned a lot. We'll continue this discussion on many, many more fronts. I believe we've got the senior services coming up next, along with Pioneer Homes and Senior Services types of programs. We'll have a discussion with those folks on how to, and Rhea, maybe how to go about organizing those meetings and making sure we have information to members, in an appropriate fashion. And everything we do is a learning process. Nothing in government is perfect. We all try our best. There's not one person who has not tried their best, absolutely. They're all very dedicated, whether it's on that side of the table or this side or staff or what it is. They're doing their best. We all realize that. It doesn't mean that we don't have to hold each other up to the highest level. You know, I know when I'm in juvenile, I say repeatedly that this has to be a team effort. You know, there's nothing that we do. You know, I don't know all the answers. You know, and we cannot become a emperor has no clothes type of a situation where everybody knows everything and doesn't respect everybody who has something to say. And, you know, because we all bring something different to the table. From the day we were born, you know, that's how we were born and ingrained, and we all have something different, and we all have a lot of different benefits that we bring to the table, listening to those and trying to make it all pull together. Again, we've got a dedicated group here. We'll continue to do this. I think our next meetings are in Wausau, so I don't have to travel this time, but I get to sleep in my own bed. It's good for me. And so with that, is there any other closing comments from the committee or members? Thanks for all your support, everybody. Thanks to the great folks here at the Fairbanks LIO. It's been a very good experience here. Provided us with coffee and donuts every morning. They were here early. A great conference room. They've done a fantastic job in facilitating these meetings. Some of the best I've been at, and they do a very good job here. So thank you to all them. All them folks there on the other side of the door, thank you for what you do. And with that, thank you, folks.
Thank you.